Thanks for listening to the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. You can contact the show at twitter.com/DW Groovecast and through Facebook at facebook.com/Drummer's Weekly Groovecast.
Good evening.
I am warning you right now, if you touch my drums, I will stab you in the neck with a knife.
Ain't it fucking.
Mom!
Take it easy. Lower it.
I'm not going to lower it. I have to do this now.
I don't mind
playing
it, but lower it.
We got straight now?
No, we had a problem. I mean, we tried to do everything we could.
What do you mean?
Well, you know what I mean.
Nice! Little trouble there. You're rushing.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Yeah!
Oh, that Philly Joe Jones, man. I hate to even think about changing that intro, even though I know I'm going to have to at some time or another.
I'll
come up with something good. How you doing, man? You're back here for your weekly beating?
What? Man, I bring the pain here, son.
That you do, man. I get nervous just sitting across the table from
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
What you been up to, man?
I have been... sitting at home, thinking about practicing, and that's about it. It's a slow period, my friend.
Well, you know, did you bring that up? Let me. I'm going to be completely honest with you about something. I was thinking about something before you got over here today. My schedule is starting, and let me say this: I am not complaining. I'm not complaining, John. I am not complaining, listening audience.
Why are your fingers crossed?
Harvey bite him. My gig schedule picks up significantly starting this week. I mean, we've been joking the entire start of the new year, but I mean, I've been gigging steadily just with my steady gigs. I haven't been doing anything extra, but I mean, the gig schedule really picks up in earnest this week.
Good.
And thankfully it does continue on. But let me tell you, man, there's this weird psychological thing I've got going on that's like,
it's over.
It's, you know, I've got to, it's back to schlepping gear, dealing with traffic, dealing with load ins, dealing with load outs, late nights. Next week, you know, I'm on the road for a little bit, you know. Does that make me an ass, John?
It's going to make you a significantly more comfortable financial ass.
So I'll take it.
So that's a long-winded way of saying yes.
Yeah. I'll take it.
You got to take it. Don't act all sanctimonious. I'll take it. You have to.
Yeah.
Who are you kidding? I have had this conversation with you before, but first and foremost, you know, for 35 years I've been in the game, I'm still like, oh, this is the one. This is it. This is where I'm going to not be able to meet my mortgage, and I'm not going to be able to, you know, this is coming. And it always works out.
Right.
And, you know, clearly January and February for most musicians is just a time where you got to be prepared for it. You got to put it away, all that. But that there is a reality to, you know, in my case, you know, as you get older and that, you know, there's always that chance that things will slow down, and you got to be kind of thinking about what you're going to do to combat that.
I think Joel Rosenblatt said something about that, right?
Yeah, okay. He did diversify in some way, shape, or form. This is just really a long-winded advertisement for my garage full of stuff that you good people need to buy.
You should start a TV show called This Old Drum.
This Old Drum.
You like that?
Most people would say I just started continue on a show called Hoarders.
I've been in that garage, man. That's a scary place at night.
I know. I don't know if you've noticed, I have been moving some things recently.
From one place to the next in the garage is what you mean.
No. To Fort Myers, Florida, to Flagstaff, Arizona, to all over, man.
That you
I'm
almost
saying goodbye to this junk.
I would say that almost.
I mean, nice gear.
That almost had like a Route 66 ring to it. There, these different cities you were going to.
How about that?
So yeah.
So anyway, certainly glad it's picking up. You know, our spring will be breathing easy, and that's good too.
You know what I figured out? What it really is in my pea mind that is the stumbling block. I think there's a subconscious fear of being on the gigs and not enjoying them. Isn't that weird?
You enjoy them?
But I mean, I really think that's what it is that, you know, I haven't been doing certain gigs as much over the past month.
Right.
You know, slamming busy through the last part of last year, like most people are. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, you know, you have that respite, which really hate looking forward and saying, there's not that much going on that month. Then all of a sudden it starts picking back up again, and you think back, you know, maybe I'm not going to enjoy it this time around. And I think that's what it is more than anything. And, you know, that's one of those weird, unfounded fears because, man, I have fun on all my gigs that I do.
I was going to say, man, I almost, as much as I dread the early part of the year, and just as working players, we all know exactly what that is. It almost is like kind of a built-in, you know, as you said, respite. And typically I end up coming back sort of refreshed and like, oh, yeah, I remember I like playing. And, you know, you're not just in the grind. Because, man, I mean, there are times of the year where you're just like, oh, you know, working a bunch and the gigs kind of run together, or you're dealing with a personality here, or a headache of traffic and this kind of thing there. And I just sort of, it always seems like come, you know, late winter, early spring, I'm like, oh yeah, I like doing this.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is for me also is I have to step back from the ledge and tell myself, hey, man, I really like everybody that I work with.
That's a big plus.
Good people. You know, and I think also another thing is that far and away the preponderance of my gigs in January were on house kits where I stroll in with in-ear monitors and a stick bag and sit down and play. Only had to move the kit once or twice, you know, and now I'm going back into full force, you know, of doing some road stuff and having to carry the kit.
Earning your money.
Stuff. I mean, I was doing that stuff this morning where, like this next weekend, not this weekend, but the following weekend where I'm going to be out of town, I'm going to be responsible for carrying my own kit. It's not going to be like in a truck or anything like that. I'm sitting here already working out the logistics. Once I get to the hotel, I'm going to get like a luggage carrier and take my kit up to the room, you know, all that mind-numbing stuff.
Man, I just leave it out in the entryway to the hotel. If it's there in the morning, cool. If it's not...
Yeah,
I get to buy a new one. Kidding.
John, did you like my segue into talking about gear?
Oh,
that was what that
I
was.
I forgot.
That's what that was, baby.
We haven't talked about gear in so long. I thought it was just. I can't even entertain it in my mind. We're going to talk about gear.
We're going to talk about gear today. You know, we made.
I might not have run on sentences and like. My brain going somewhere else.
Well, we made these veiled threats like 4 or 5 months ago that, hey, guys, we're going to talk about gear, and then we just never talk about gear.
Well, we fell prey to that. We really like how your podcast reached out to other players and musicians. Yeah. We ate that. We just drank that Kool-Aid, man.
That we did, but now we come back and we stick it in their face.
And next week we're going to talk about spring training only. Kidding.
If anybody can seriously help us out with figuring out when tickets are going to go on sale down there, that'd help us out.
In Atlanta, it seems to be.
I know.
They're not concerned with selling tickets or something.
I mean, I can walk backwards to the park from here, but can't get in.
Crazy. Hey, back to your segue.
Yeah.
We are doing the snare drum show.
Man, that was a good roll. That's the best roll I've heard you play, man. Even?
Don't make me cuss you out right now.
Our little...
It was actually... I That was a dog that did it. I didn't do that.
No, man, I'm into snare drums, and I know you are.
You know it, and I know everybody who's listening probably is too. A subject that never seems to get old, and opinions, which, disclaimer, we may have a few of today. Don't get your whatever you're wearing in a wad. It's going to be all right, guys. You can dismiss any opinion I have, and I'll be okay.
Well, let me tell you, there are enough different variables in snare drums to have a million different opinions, you know.
Yeah, you can have a million positive opinions about snare drums because there's a lot of good ones.
Yeah, and, you know, the way we're going to approach this show today, we're gonna look at it in a few different ways, and we're going to talk about things about, of course, brands of snare drums. We're going to talk about things like shell composition, bearing edges, hardware on the drums, throw-offs. We're going to talk about drum head choices, all that good stuff.
Nice.
Yeah.
And I'm so, in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, this is definitely in your wheelhouse, man. I'm going to sit back and take notes. I mean, I've got my...
You don't have to go to college to be well-versed in snare drums.
Snare drumology.
I am. Yeah, I didn't have a teacher. I learned this on my own, and you can too.
So, you know what? I just thought of this. Let's, you and I both tell the listening folks how many snare drums we currently own. John, how many do you have in your own, not that you're selling, but your private personal arsenal?
I used to have about 50.
Yeah.
But now I have 12.
Okay.
And it was really like, why do I have 50 snare drums?
I never had 50. I think the most that I probably had at any one time was maybe low 20s, like 22, 23. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm down to about 15 or 16 now, of which, and I'll throw this in, of which I really use only about half a dozen consistently. Yep. The others are back. I got into that weird thing, man, of when I was doing a lot of recording that I wanted to be able to go reach for any drum, and it was already tuned, you know, right. And I didn't have to do a whole lot of modifications.
So
I had
thing, and you know exactly what it does.
Yeah, and I had several duplicates of some of the go-tos that tuned up well in different ranges, and therefore, you know, if I wanted this one particular drum, I could go for a super low tuning and then reach right across the room and grab the same drum that was tuned up high, you know, if I needed that.
Yeah, I was into that, like, clearly, and, you know, when I was doing a lot of rentals, I had a bunch of that ready to go kind of thing. And then when I was recording more, that same kind of mentality.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it's funny, man. I use maybe four.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, that they're just incredible and work in the settings I'm looking for, and that's about it. But I still hang on to some for... you know, maybe for vanity's sake, or maybe just because, you know, I don't know. But
well,
I'll sell some.
You and I are also the type of fellas that if there's something that we like, and especially if we find it at a ridiculous price, we can't pass up a bargain. As I like to tell the wife, you would have lost money if you hadn't bought that.
It's a fine point,
you know,
and I will stand behind you,
folks. The way we're gonna start talking about these snare drums, John and I, we made our own little personal lists of our favorite drums for our different styles. And then also we're going to each talk about kind of some under the radar, we'll call them kind of our sleeper snare drums, good specialty drums that we may not use all the time, but certainly do the job when needed. So, John, do you want to go first with your first one?
Yeah. There's this obscure company called Ludwig.
And Never heard of them. Sounds like a nice German respectable name, though.
It definitely... I think they're making a respectable product that I think will at some point become kind of the standard. They just found this little magic in their metal snare drums. Regardless of shell compositions, as we mentioned earlier.
They make one out of iron?
No.
All right. Lead? You said metal.
So?
Go ahead.
Why are you calling
on
them out, man? They're doing. They got enough variation.
Nobody knows who they are, man. I can. You know,
all right.
Punch,
enough of this.
Punch the little guy.
Look, we all. I can't imagine that anyone doesn't agree, man. Ludwig, if they did one thing right in their opposite of many things they've done wrong over the years, their metal snare drums are second to none. And we know that starts with the construction of them, which is a seamless sponge shell. And I will argue to the death with anyone who says that doesn't make a difference, because I just truly believe it does. Above and beyond sound, there's a feel to it.
Totally agree.
There's just a tone to it that, you know, when you've been throwing mics up on drums and studios and you're set up and you start hearing the difference when you really dial them in. So, there's just none better in the metal side of snare drums than Ludwig. Just fantastic. And there are, mind you, some amazing, especially in recent years, some amazing metal snare drums that are hitting the market. But I mean, you can go get a $60 Acrolite, mm-hmm. and it'll sound like $1 million with a little bit of attention, and it just goes up from there as far as their offerings. So that's kind of to start it all off, an opinion that I won't be swayed from.
Well, ironically enough, that's one of my choices also, John. In other words, I had it down for what I'm going to call it my go-to rock and pop snare drum. Mm-hmm. And I even narrowed it down a little bit more. I just used the Superphonic. I do have some of the brass drums, like the Black Beauty. I've got a chrome over, got a couple of chrome over brasses, a couple of Black Beauties. But it seems like my ears always go back to just the regular old Lud Eloy Superphonic snare drums, man. And it doesn't matter what depth. Man, mm-hmm. I'll use either the 5 or the 6.5 and love them both. I've got one of the 402s, which is the 6.5, mm-hmm. and then I have got, I think, 3 of the 5-inch depth. One that I call it my Frankenstein drum, because it's got all kinds of weird Ludwig parts. It's got like the old what's not the Imperial, the Imperial lugs is what you normally have on those
right.
drums. What are the other lugs called, man, that are on like the Pioneer drums and the
maybe just classic?
The classic. It's got one of them has got it the looks classic
like,
lugs.
Yeah. Yeah. It looks like kind of like the Acrolite lug.
Exactly.
But flat. Yeah.
Exactly. I've got...
That's what it is.
Yeah.
Whatever that lug is.
I've got one of those drums that I picked up, I think, for like $50.
Yum.
That somebody had parted out, you know, and had put all kinds of weird stuff. No extra holes or anything. And man, that drum sounds like $1 million. Especially that one sounds really good, tuned up just a little bit higher. And let me say this also. I primarily, on all of those drums, use just a plain old coated single-ply head on top. The mm-hmm. one I've been using is just the Aquarian texture coated, and then just a regular clear snare side head on the bottom. I don't care what range I tune it up to. I've tuned the things up to where they're like bongo heads, and I've tuned them down to where they're boggy 1977 Don Henley on the long run, and they sound great, man. Regular triple flanged hoops. I know some people love to put die cast hoops on those, and like to put especially die cast hoops on the Black Beauties.
I don't care. I think for me, die cast is more of a feel thing.
There's a height to them also that can also be a little off,
a little weird. So yeah. I don't, that Ludwig sound too, man. To me, is the triple flange is part of the thing. I do have a little secret.
Yeah.
On all but one of my Ludwig metal drums, I have brass hoops.
Well, and I do is, on one of my Ludwig drums that we'll talk about in a little while. It's a little bit of a rarity, the one I'm going to talk about, but go ahead. Yeah.
This is in combination with the Ludwig metal snare drums. The brass hoops are really cool. And I have a one that has the original like 60s era brass hoops, like 1.6 millimeter. But I bought three or four pairs of 2.3 millimeter brass, which are amazing. And I have one on, I have one of my drums I can't put down is an old 60s Superphonic.
Yeah.
That was just pitted out. I had it stripped and then powder coated. And it's a little drier, but, and I put these brass hoops on there. And man, that drum, I can't quit playing it.
Did the brass hoop dry it out a little bit?
No. No, maybe just a little smoother attack, maybe a little. Not, I don't know about drying it out. I notice it more with the thinner brass hoops. I notice more of a difference than the thicker ones, but there's something about the combination of that, like that shell works with that brass somehow, and it I hear the difference. You know, some people say you're crazy.
Yeah.
You can hear the difference between Duracell and Eveready or whatever. You know, like, no. I really do hear it, but brass hoops, man, try it.
You know, we've been glomming on the praise for these, but you and I both know that there are some little eccentricities about these drums that
we'll talk
about as well. And the first ones, we got to talk about the strainers. There's some weirdness on there. And let me say this also. On all of my Ludwig metal drums, whether they are the chrome over brass or the Black Beauties or just the plain old metal Superphonics, none of them, and I repeat, none of them have the super sensitive strainer. That's a no-no.
No, I don't like that at all.
Yeah. They're just trouble is what they are. They're just waiting to break, and they fit weird in cases and all that. Because, you know, if it's hard to describe those strainers unless you kind of know what they are. But, yeah, you probably want to stay away from those, especially if you don't know what they are, if you see something that says super sensitive. So, first off, yeah, none of the strainers that I'm talking about that are even wonky are the super sensitive. They're wonky enough on the regular Superphonic.
Mm-hmm.
So, John, I know one of the things that you and I talk about is that the Superphonics notoriously have a problem with the fine tensioning knob on the strainer side to pull out or to loosen as you go along through the night. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing everybody needs to be aware of.
There's a solution.
Go for it.
There are little black rubber washer-like things. I have a bag of like 150 of them. I don't know where I got them. I don't know. I have, you know, you put it down on the threads, and when you get it to the tension you want it, that little rubber gasket sits right down on the face of the front part of the strainer and keeps it from backing out.
Are you saying that is a better solution than me just taking a big old fat rubber band and winding it around the entire mechanism?
Yes, because you can turn it off.
You can turn the snares off.
But there is another solution. Get rid of the P85.
And
eventually it's going to be trouble. I have there's some people that had some issues with these early on and they got their reputation suffered, but that Millennium strainer, P86, I have three of those and I've never had any trouble with them. I think they might all be the later version because I had one that crapped out and they somehow fixed it. It was like a rivet issue or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had no problems. And like on two of my drums I use regularly, I have that. There is a new one that a couple friends of mine who I trust to no end are raving about, this Indie strainer. It's a newer company, INDE, I think. And they made a strainer to accommodate the typical Ludwig holes. You don't drill or anything, and it's really good. At the same time, you know, and it looks kind of like it fits on a Ludwig drum. It looks like it look in context, it makes sense. Then again, you can get a retrofit for just about anyone, you know. I know Trick has a template or retro piece that you can put on a Ludwig because people love Ludwig drums. So make sure your strainer can accommodate that 2.38-inch, whatever it is, distance, you know. So there's some solutions to a wonky one besides rubber bands and gaskets.
And the other solution that I think everybody needs to be aware of is you better have some lug locks with you, because it's just going to, if you play any kind of rim shot with any kind of volume, the area on the batter side, and to some extent even on the resonant side, on the snare side head, the tension rods will have a tendency to back out. Yeah. And so you need some lug locks on those things. But if you get the lug locks and you get the fine tensioning knob on the strainer worked out, man, you'll never have a better drum in your life.
No. You know, speaking of the lug locks thing, I'm kind of a freak in that just psychologically, I put them on the bottom.
Yeah.
At least on the half closest to me, because I just don't want to be thinking about it. And especially, man, if you have a tube lug drum, those bottom are going to go, because they have to be lined up perfectly. Whereas, you know, that Imperial lug has a little give to it, as does that Classic lug. There's a little splay enough to keep it from backing out. But, man, a tube lug drum will just back out in a heartbeat underneath on the bottom side.
Yeah, good point.
So lock them down, man. Yeah. Then you're not thinking about it. Sounds like $1 million for just about as long as you want. Because these drums will sound great with a beat-up old head, even.
Ludwig, I will send you the mailing address for the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast for the advertisement check.
Yeah, right.
John, I'm going to move on. I think we've given them enough love. I'm going to give everybody my choice for my go-to jazz snare drum. And everybody better sit down for this one, because you're not going to see this one coming.
Or put on your weightlifting belt.
Put on, grab your kettlebells and start a swinging.
Phil has taken this drum to a gig, and like his voice goes up an octave.
Man, I've ruined a couple of snare drum stands with this one. My go-to jazz snare drum is one that I picked up about 20 years ago. Through the recommendation and the advice of the great Kenny Washington, because he had one and just swears by it. And this guy, he's got ears, man. He can hear paint dry. And so I picked up a Keplinger 6.5x14 snare drum. Mm. Now, for those of you who go, never heard of it, well, you're probably in pretty good company, because most people have never heard of it. There's a guy up in Seattle that makes these snare drums out of 3mm rolled stainless steel. And the shell itself weighs about 30 pounds. And once you put the rest of the hardware on it, it's about 33 to 35 pound drum. And so you're sitting there thinking, wait, this guy uses it for jazz? Man, let me tell you, this thing has one of the most crisp and articulate responses with brushes that you will ever hear. As a matter of fact, it's hard for me to even play most other drums with brushes and get the same kind of feel and response from it.
There's no reason to play another one then.
I mean, it's amazing. And again, I use just plain old Aquarian texture-coated single-ply head on the top, clear snare side on the bottom. It's got a great no-frills style strainer on it. Sounds like $1 million. It cost about $1 million. I got a ridiculous deal on it. This was back, do you remember when Ayotte was making, or Keplinger was making the drum, but he was selling it through Ayotte?
Yeah, I do remember.
Yeah. I had a relationship with a company that had a relationship with them, and they got me the drum for just a few $100. And you know, those drums now are $1,500 or more. Maybe something like that. But the Keplinger stainless.
Pearl Jam, man.
Yeah. They're the ones that made it go through the roof.
Pearl Jam. Yeah. And, Soundgarden. I think Matt plays one of those too.
And let me tell you, it does work incredibly well for rock, because let me tell you, it will absolutely rock the house. And this, by the way, does not have wood hoops on it. It's got just triple flange steel hoops. Love it. But like I mentioned earlier, you better have a Husky snare drum stand, because I just destroyed a lightweight Pearl stand with it.
Oh.
Yeah, I know, John. That's in your wheelhouse.
Man. No, you just don't. If we're going to say something bad about something, don't mention that.
I'm going to give him some props here in a little while, though, too. But, yeah, I just destroyed a lightweight stand with that thing. So you have to take a pretty husky double brace stand to hold a 35-pound drum. So that's what I got.
Greg Keplinger. That is a fine drum, my friend.
Love it, man.
My Facebook friend. He even said happy birthday to me one day. I was like, man, cool.
Greg did?
I almost bought a snare drum just because he said happy birthday to me.
You could do worse.
Almost. And then I looked at my
wallet,
bank account, and thought about January. So, go-to jazz snare drum. Anyone who knows me knows I'm a big fan of Joe Montaneri's creations. And when it comes to wood drums especially, I can't say I've connected with a commercial wood snare drum from any company, like their stock drums. They just kind of like, they'll just sort of leave me flat. And there's been a few custom guys that just kind of have the magic, and Joe is at the top of that list. And I've owned a number of his drums, but I have one that's a 5x14 10-ply maple. It's got die cast hoops, and I use an earth tone head actually on that one. And it's just, it's kind of got the magic, like super sensitive, crispy, everything I like in a drum for that setting. It just works, and I don't second guess it. I don't try to do anything else. If I'm doing any kind of straight ahead gig or any kind of, or more organic kind of thing, I use that drum.
What is the shell composition on that one?
10-ply maple.
Maple. Yeah.
It's all about attention to detail with Joe. Like, just exceptional edges, a really gradual snare bed, which really lends to the sensitivity part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of guys making drums, but I've never played a Joe drum that I didn't absolutely love, and I can't say that about a number of others. And so that's the one that I hang on to, and it's, again, one that doesn't, I never retune it or change the approach of it. It just, and obviously I'm not wearing that head out, so it just stays in its bag until that gig comes up.
What kind of snares, like the number of snares do you use? Like a 20-strand snare?
It's a 20.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't like a real, like some people are like, 42. And I think it gets a little, I'm just not a big, my problem with 42s is you get that tension in the middle of it. But you start getting out to the outsides, and mm-hmm. just by physics, you're going to suffer a little bit, and it can get a little noisy if you're not wanting to get, like a 42 from like that Don Henley thing. That right. rocks, But when you're talking about crisp, 42 isn't necessarily crisp.
No.
Kind of messy.
Yeah.
So a 20, I've kind of stumbled onto a little hidden gem in snare wire world. Pearl has these ones called Ultra Sound.
Mm-hmm.
And conceptually, some people might roll their eyes, but they have three different styles. One, the snares in the middle of the length are a little looser for like more higher volume.
Interesting.
For high volume things. So they create them where they're a little looser. They have another that the snares in the middle are a little more tight and constricted, and that's for more sensitivity. And then they have one that's even tension the whole way. But what I like about these snares is they're really affordable, only like $15. They also have the raised part where you can put string through without it being flat. And that's,
gotcha. Yeah.
I'm really into that. If I have an older drum that I use string on, I like that raised hole, where you don't have that just flat, and the string's kind of basically lifting it off the.
Sure.
So that's a cool thing. Anyway, that's what I use on that drum.
Cool. You bring up a good thing talking about, the different snare wires.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that years ago there was a rage about, there were a couple of companies who were making new premium snare wires. I never heard that much difference.
No, man, I think there's, like, Tama makes a really great, like, they've had on their Star Classics.
Yeah.
Just well-designed, straight-up metal, you know, and they sounded amazing. I don't hear a lot of difference. Like, some guys got into that, oh, German brass.
Right.
And so I just think, man, you're starting to get into just, you know, like, bragging rights kind of thing, if anything. It's, you know, the boutique mentality versus, is it really making a difference?
I feel like that is probably more applicable to orchestral stuff, because, you know, orchestral drums a lot of times have multiple strainers,
right,
you know,
that's
on
a
it.
Good point.
And I think that especially when you've got some that are right beside each other, you can probably tell a difference in, like, you know, the bronze and the German silvers and stuff like that.
Gut, even.
Yeah.
That stuff.
Yeah. Right. You know,
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think in our typical application, there's, I'm not going to spend $29.95 when something's half that and, you know, sounds just as good.
I completely agree. Yeah. And I think that's especially true even on the metal drums we were talking about before.
Totally. Yeah. No question about that.
So, John, I'm going to go with my next pick, and I'm going to call it my Piccolo Snare Pick. And this one, you could probably put it under my...
Use it for your Spin Doctors tribute band?
Absolutely, man. They'd be Aaron Comess would be proud of this pick. So would Steve Jordan.
That's
as
true.
Well, would be proud of this one.
Steve uses that drum.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself.
I picked up, I guess probably 15 years or so, an old Ludwig. There's that name again from that company that nobody knows about.
Those guys.
A Ludwig Jazz Combo. And there was, this was the drum that its predecessor, I think, was called like a Bebop or something. WFL made a Bebop. But this is a 3x13, the true piccolo size, Ludwig Jazz Combo. It's just a wood shell. It's got the nickel over brass hardware on
and
it.
And hoops,
yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And man, let me tell you, brother, that thing has got, the best way I can say it, it's got a pop that is unmistakable to any other piccolo drum than I've ever played. And let me tell you, I've got a 3x13 Black Beauty, and I'll take this Jazz Combo over that 3x13 Black Beauty.
Nice.
Yeah, it is, it's almost beastly.
I kind of like the idea of a drum that small,
mm-hmm,
being wood. It kind of takes a little bit of that brashness out of it, maybe, and the brass hoops, of course, as well.
Right.
You know, it makes sense that would be more pleasing to you.
Yeah.
Ears in a lot of ways. And clearly, you know, the 3x13 Black Beauty, a great drum, a quality drum, but there's so many other ones on the market that are, you know, similar size and metal composition that sounds almost like it's not as attractive as the mojo of that Bebop drum. There's something magic,
right,
in that drum.
There absolutely is. It does have its little eccentricities, kind of like some of the other Ludwig drums. It's got that, we couldn't think of the exact model of the strainer that's on there, but it's got that same little bit of an issue with the fine tension.
47 people right now are saying, blah, 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 blah.
Right. Email us.
I know what it is, but I just forgot.
Can't remember the name. Yeah, it has a tendency for that fine-tuning knob to want to back out again on it. And on, here's an interesting thing also. On this little drum like this, the, you know, 3 inches by 13, I am almost positive that it's a real narrow set of snare strands, maybe like a 16.
Maybe even less than that.
Yeah.
Like, even on some old Rogers marching drums, man, they were like 12.
It could be. And this, everything on this drum is stock, including the snares, man.
Wow.
From the early 60s. This drum is somewhere like around a 63, 64, mm-hmm, is what it is. The only thing that's different on it are the heads. But everything else is stock.
You know who else has that drum and loves it is Keith Rumfola.
Really?
Yeah. I've actually played that, and it's got a cool vibe to it for sure.
Keith Rumfola.
What's
one
up,
of our
Keith?
Power listeners.
Man, we need to hang out, dude. It's been
absolutely
too long.
Come be third mic on the show sometime. Just hang out.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
We can talk about all those K's you're going to leave to me.
And a 3x13 jazz combo snare.
Yeah, because Phil doesn't need either of them. So come on, Keith. I'll buy lunch and bring that Will.
This thing took a morbid turn, man.
If anybody can appreciate morbid. There you go. Yeah. Called you out.
John, what's your next drum?
My next drum is, kind of that piccolo vibe for me.
Yeah.
It's going to get real redundant, fellas. I got a 5x13 Montaneri. I put some wood hoops on it, which is really cool. And it just slays. It's so... And interestingly enough, like even the tuning range is incredible on it. I don't play it much, but man, when I want it, like I'll put it off to my left on occasion, and it'll just take your head off and sound like it just sounds like $1 million.
Is it a maple drum?
Yeah.
Also, yeah.
Yeah. Most of Joe's stuff it tends to be maple for good reason. That particular wood really works well on snare drums.
Yeah, just to put a little button on that jazz combo, that was made during the time also of when Ludwig used the white paint on the inside of the drums. And so I'm sure it's the traditional, maple and poplar?
Probably mahogany.
Mahogany.
Maybe
blend.
Mahogany with maybe like maple reinforcement hoops is what I'm guessing.
Yeah, right, because it does have hoops.
Probably, yeah. It's probably a 3-ply mahogany and then that... they didn't really get into that maple poplar until pretty late in the 60s.
Yeah, and this was definitely earlier 60s when this drum was made.
So, yeah, Montaneri again. Joe, good Lord, dude. I love your drums.
Well, now I'm going to go into my little cache of a couple of what I called wild card or sleeper drums, and John's got a few of those as well. These are drums that I don't use all the time, but when I do use them for the specific reasons that I use them, they are about the best.
Perfect for
they do.
That's cool.
And the first one I'm going to mention is an older, and I can say older now because it's almost 30 years old, a late 80s Gretsch 6.5x14 USA Maple Custom that came as a part of the first set of Gretsch USA Customs I ever bought. Now, this drum it's a pretty polarizing drum because most people really don't like it, and I'm going to be quite honest with you, I don't like it except for the one thing that I've got it tuned for. And I have it tuned exactly for what John was mentioning about 10 or 15 minutes ago, for that mid-late 70s uber deep, the heads are falling off and the snares are hanging barely by a thread to get that old 70s super deep snare drum sound. And you know, it's one of those Gretsch drums with the thin shell, die cast hoops top and bottom, lightning throw off. I do have a 40 strand snare on it where it's just barely a hanging, and I never hit a rim shot on it, just dead center, get that thud out of it. And it's perfect for that job.
I love it, man. That I can hear it as we speak.
I believe right now that drum head on there is a reverse dot, single ply with a reverse dot, tuned down boggy.
See, that's funny, man. I love that head on my deeper Ludwig metal drums. I use that head almost exclusively on all of those, and it, you know, even at a higher tuning, that head seems to work really well with that deeper 6.5 Ludwig thing. The other thing, man, about, you know, that vibe, that 70s vibe, a lot of people kind of lose sight of the fact that a big part of that sound, and you can certainly, with the patience and the right approach, get it, but man, some of that sound that a lot of people don't understand is those were going to tape. And, you know, they're saturating the levels on that because you could do that in analog and you could do that with tape. And some of that Don Henley sound, for lack of better, man, the magic in it is how it was recorded as much as how it was tuned.
Right.
And, you know, when you can get that just super low tuning and the loose snares and then just cream the levels on tape, man, that's when the magic really happens. And like I said, you know, if you really are, you know, take your time and you can do it in the digital world, but a lot of that happened by way of happy accidents, probably, like, whoa, that sounds amazing. And,
right,
you know, it's just in the red, you know, the whole time. And there's just some magic. It's kind of like guitars are the same way, man. A lot of times when you can just have them in the red, especially on tape, man, there's some mojo to that.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
Little side note.
Yeah, that drum, that Gretsch drum that I was just describing, I don't think it has been used for anything but that ever. Mm-hmm. Because even when I got that drum set, I think I used a different snare.
Had something else.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. That's cool. I mean, it's serving its purpose then.
Yeah. And I'm one of those guys. I actually like the Lightning throw off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I know that's okay.
It's all right, man.
I was gonna say that's a bit of a polarizing statement, you know. But yeah, I do. I don't have a thing against the old Lightning throw off. But then again, for it works absolutely perfectly for what I'm using it for. Although in part of the weirdness of the eccentricity of that, if you have the snares too loose, the Lightning throw off will just fall off on its
completely
own. Yeah. So you do have to have enough tension on it to keep the throw off from not just it disengaging on its own.
Right. The drawback to the drop throw.
Yeah.
So, man, you have another one that I am always fascinated with.
You talk about that one. This is another one of those drums made by one of the big manufacturer. And there's just a little bit of a story about this one. I got, for almost nothing, one of those old Yamaha, it's a 5.5 by 14 John Robinson nail drum. And it's a birch shell, it's a wooden drum, birch shell die cast hoops top and bottom. It's got that really well-built snare strainer where you got fine tensioning knobs on both sides of it. But I guess the marketing ploy on this was they took copper nails and drove them down into the bearing edge of the batter side of the drum, and then they then cut the edges to where you can see the nails, or at least the nail heads, sitting on top. Right. And so
it's down in the
Uh-huh.
So not where the head,
Head actually touches, but you can see it on the bevel. Right. You know, you can see.
A dumb question, but some people be like, "Isn't the nail going to the head?"
Right. Yeah.
No. And
I went to this store that was going out of business, and they had actually had JR doing a clinic just prior to that. And this was a store that was...
He shut them down,
man.
So good, they just said, we're not going to top this.
The groove was so deep, we got to shut it down. And so they had everything on, like, I mean, pennies on the dollar was what it was. And if anybody knows their history on that drum, that was an expensive drum.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just doing this thing where I was going through this wall of snare drums, just with a stick, just pop, 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 hitting each one. And then I got to that one drum and I, pow, and I hit it. And I was like, whoa, whoa. So I just picked the thing up and took it into the little desk area where the employee was at. And I'm like, man, is that this drum? This is the actual price on this drum. And he goes, yeah. He goes, man, we're blowing it out. And he goes, this is the one that JR used when he did the clinic a few weeks ago. So it was actually still tuned. It had Still had muffling on it also, a little bit of muffling on that top head.
John, it was as John played it and tuned it.
And man, it sounded like a million bucks. So I paid pennies on the dollar.
Well, just tell us, for God's sake.
What I paid for it?
Yeah.
I think I paid $220 for
Thank you.
Yeah. And
I see that all day on sites. Oh, you wouldn't believe what I'm paying. So, well, try me.
Yeah, I believe that. Wasn't that drum like an $800 or $900 drum?
Yeah, I want to say it was in the 6 to 7 range, maybe.
I steal my thunder.
No, dude. Yeah. Just seems like, I mean, most of those signature drums, you had the Anton Fig, you had the Roy. They were like in that 550 to 6 range.
Yeah.
So I would imagine it was similar. Still a great deal, man. It's going to be okay. You need a hug?
Not from you.
Look, man, I'm not trying to one up you here, man. You asked.
you big leaguing me, man?
No. No. I'm a number nerd, you know, when it comes to, I have to know value in order to make money. So.
Duly noted.
I love you, man. It's going to be okay. You got an amazing deal. I would put that up on your Facebook today. Like, man, I got this drum for $220, and I get you. Some geek is going to be like, well, that's an incredible deal. You saved 74.296%.
Bro, I've come to the conclusion nothing positive happens on Facebook. Look that's at the true. Action this past week, brother.
Mm. Anyway.
It's a little inside note to John and I.
Yuck.
But... yeah, that drum really sounds great. I mean, it really does.
That's amazing because I have never played a Birch drum that I've connected with. They typically have that weird mid-range, hollowed out, not very sensitive kind of thing.
This one sounds good, man.
That's crazy.
And I would have never even thought about it until I hit it, you know, in the store. And I was like, wow, boy, this thing sounds good. And so that's my other wild card drum that I use. And I had actually used it a fairly good amount over this past year on some rock and pop gigs.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So it's paid for itself.
Absolutely.
10 times over, or maybe 20 with what you paid for it.
Thank you.
I'm here for you, man. Sleepers. I've owned all of these. I have a couple still, but some snare drums that are just unbelievable for next to nothing. One is the early Legend snare drums, and that was a company, Command started a line of drums. Really high quality, you know, all maple, serious attention to detail. Kind of had a Gretsch vibe. They were die-cast hoops on the toms, I think, and... maybe not. I don't remember. But they had on their snare drums, especially the early ones, which I think they introduced first, they had die-cast hoops. They were 10-ply maple drums. And the first run of them were actually made by Joe Montaneri and his brother Paul. There's a little bit of sketchy info on them, but I've kind of, Paul seems to think like most of them with that were the tape, the glued on badge with a solid red dot. He said a lot of those were probably made by them, and that take that for what it's worth, because they may have, after Joe and Paul made that initial run of 50 or 100 or whatever they made, they might have used the same badge.
Mm-hmm.
But basically it comes down to these drums were designed by Joe, and they're essentially a Joe Montaneri drum, and they sound amazing. I've owned 7 or 8 of them, and they're all just super high quality. And the snare drum strainers are a little wacky. They're the drop style, and they're temperamental, but the drums themselves, the edges, the gradual beds, all the philosophy that Joe has are really, you know, and you know, the secret's out a little bit on them, but man, they're incredible. And even the after they made them, the more what's the word I'm looking for, the multiple factory made drums,
you know
are, they're really high quality and sound great.
So just one quick thing on that before we leave those. Was it one of those things where Joe and Paul did the majority of the manufacturing on them and then they were maybe assembled somewhere else? Because you were talking about how the badges were put on there. Or...
I'll have to ask Paul, but it was my understanding they actually made the initial run of these drums, however many, I don't remember, but they made them themselves. They built and stained and all that and sent them off. And then they oversaw, maybe Joe oversaw the handoff and the production.
Gotcha.
So a production model that were made after the fact were to his specifications, I think. And, you know, man, the Montaneris aren't shy about correcting me. So if it's wrong, you guys feel free to bury me in all my old man confusion and foggy history, but
in public on social media, please.
Yeah, that. I love that. I love being called to the carpet by drum manufacturers. Moving on. So I don't have to wrap myself in bubble wrap socially anytime soon. Another one that I love that's a real sleeper is the Roy Haynes Yamaha copper signature model. Amazingly cool drum. It's kind of got, almost sounds kind of wood in a way. You know, copper kind of has that warmer, woodyish kind of vibe to it. I'm not going to get into a lot of it. It has that same strainer that they use on the Weckl drum.
Yep.
Really nice, well-designed strainer. It's not the double like the Weckl drum. It's just one, but... Mm-hmm. I think the Roy's actually hammered
copper. Yeah.
It's got a bead in the middle. I think it goes in instead of out, but, it had the chrome version of the Maple Custom lug.
Yeah.
But really a great drum, pretty expensive. And even to this day, you know, people love them. So they're hard to find, but an incredible drum. Pearl Jupiter.
Yes, sir.
A sleeper of all sleepers is a mid to late 70s, I think, for the most part, chrome over brass drum.
Mm-hmm.
The most famous, a lot of session guys have one of these that kind of sits around and gets used, but Stuart Copeland was the guy that you could hear it in all its glory and what it does well, and it does a lot well. It's well, great tuning range on that, as is typically a brass drum, you know, has to offer. But that Police stuff was pretty much a Pearl Jupiter.
John, I've got the close cousin to that. Mm-hmm. I've got that Pearl Rock, which is brass. It's a brass drum also. Mm-hmm. Now, do you recall, man, what is the main difference between the... I know there's a strainer difference.
I'd have to see yours.
Yeah.
The Jupiters that I've owned, they were chrome over brass. I don't remember if they're seamless or not. I'd have to kind of go back and revisit that.
The Rock that I've got, it's got a traditional Superphonic style strainer on it.
Yeah.
It's got a triple bead that goes around the center.
They're kind of shallow,
correct,
flat. That's the same shell, I think.
Yeah.
And they might have just done some overhaul. Maybe the lugs are a little different and maybe the strainer's a little different, but it's probably the same drum, and that might even be cheaper than the Jupiter because the Jupiter's gotten so much love in recent years.
I bought that drum on eBay for $24.
Taking a chance on it, or did you know it was brass?
I knew it was brass.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's great because I've known some people that fell into those.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, I was at a garage sale for $10, and it was like,
yeah.
Then they realized what it was.
Yeah, and when it came in, I mean, it was in perfect shape, no problems putting heads on them. Everything was, strainer works fine. Strainer works better than the Ludwig strainers.
It's awesome.
You know.
Yeah, I know what strainer you're talking about. That's a great find. My last little sleeper, and you can get for dirt cheap, is the Ludwig standard snare drums. They came in both wood and aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
The wood one is basically a Jazz Fest, which, you know, a lot of people hate Jazz Fest, but if you're going to get one, look for a Ludwig standard because it's the same shell. Lugs are fine. Three ply mahogany with maple reinforcement. A lot of them are painted white.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a poor man's jazz festival.
I was going to ask you, are the lugs the same on this as on the jazz festival?
No, they're those rounded rocker lugs.
Gotcha. Like, yeah.
Standard lugs became rocker.
Gotcha. And so the standard lugs were on the jazz festival, right?
No, they had that classics.
Classical. Okay. Yeah. That's the kind of lugs that are on that Frankenstein Superphonic that I was telling you about. The classic.
I've seen four or five of those Superphonics. Like maybe one day when they were still in Chicago, or I think it was when they're still in Chicago, typically they might have run out of Imperials and they made Superphonics with those. I've seen some of those before. The aluminum standard is a little different than your Acolyte in that it's a straight shell. There's no bead. And it is welded, but those drums sound great, man. They have some of that Ludwig mojo, maybe a little different, but really, really a great sounding drum, and you can get them for dirt cheap. So there's a couple, either Ludwig standards or eight lugs typically, so they're not chintzing on that.
Yeah.
But really pretty awesome, high quality stuff for next to nothing.
I think we gave the folks some good gear stuff this week, man.
Yeah. I do want to get...
Scratching the itch.
I want to get into one thing that is really ever popular, and that's the solid shell stuff.
Oh, okay.
And, man, there's some amazing solid shell drums. You know, I'm a Noble and Cooley. I love Noble and Cooley's solid shell stuff.
Yeah.
Craviato, obviously. And there's a few other companies that have some offerings, but I've owned a few. I'm not nuts about them typically because they tend to be real temperamental. Tuning from one room to another, tuning. I have a theory about that. I think solid shells are kind of like this living, breathing organism, if you will. And they they're just going to be temperamental like we are. Like, you know, yeah, I'm amazing one day. Maybe I'm not the next. But if anybody has a line on how to tame that beast, I fight them a little more than me. I love the typical ply shell, especially made by a craftsman. They're really hard to go wrong with. You kind of can't make them sound bad. Whereas solid shells, I wrestle with them a little bit. But I've owned a couple, man. I had a Noble and Cooley that's a magic drum.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, anybody got an opinion on those? I know there's guys that just cannot get enough of a Craviato they own. And I don't doubt they're amazing.
And, man, they don't give them away.
No, but they're definitely a vibe to them, too.
Even resale, you know, they don't give them away.
They're up there.
You know. Before we get off this solid shell thing, I do want to say something, and I think we'd be remiss after bringing up the solid shell stuff if we don't talk about Radio King snare drums.
Yes, yes.
To your point about the fickleness of those drums, I know that people are going to lose their mind when I say this, but I've played on several Radio King snare drums, and I've known several different people that have those snare drums. Man, to me, those are the boxiest, weirdest sounding drums. I've got no love for those, man. I've never heard anybody that's tuned one up that sounded great to me.
Mm.
They don't live up to the hype, in my opinion.
Interesting.
And especially the price.
There's certainly, you know, it's a sexy purchase because of the legend that has grown around them. I will say, first and foremost, it's such an inexact science, especially at that time. I mean, certainly the manufacturing of a solid shell has improved immensely and are far more consistent. But in the 50s and the 40s and 50s, you're bending wood, you know, steaming and bending wood. I mean, how could it not be a bunch of them don't sound great? And, you know, then you're talking about, you know, who's edging them, who's drilling them, you know, like so many factors that, you know, a loose, fast and loose production at that point. my theory on Radio Kings is this. Everybody, you know, Jeff Beccaro would rave about his Radio King, and every engineer is like, oh, he's got this Radio King. I kind of feel like the legend grew out of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At least in modern day, you know, I'm sure Krupa got to pick the cream of the crop, and it probably sounded like $1 million. And, you know, whoever back in the day that was well known, that was, you know, touting them, well, they got to pick the good ones. My theory is this, and I kind of have it on good authority that this is sort of loosely the deal. Beccaro's Radio King, what people fail to know or realize is
that Jeff Beccaro was playing it.
That is a I'm pretty much all right.
Yeah.
See you guys. Thanks. See you next good night. Week. There were some techs out there, Joe Montaneri being one. There's that name again. Paul Jameson, maybe, but basically, that Beccaro drum was a perfect shell, a Radio King with a perfect shell. And then they tweaked it to death, probably re-edged it, probably redid the, and I should ask Joe about this, but, mm-hmm. you know, made the bearing, like, they had those, like, kind of real radical snare beds and, you know, like, real hit or miss with that, even if they were in line. You know, Joe, let's just use Joe. Let's just say Joe found that drum
mm-hmm.
and tweaked it out and brought it to a session, and Beccaro hit it and said, this is blowing my mind. And yeah, it was a magic drum. Well, all you hear about is like, man, Beccaro's Radio King is to die for. There's not the addendum. Yeah, well, Joe or Jeff or, you know, whoever, you know, Paul Jameson, whoever, tweaked that thing to the heavens and probably owned 5 or 6 of them that were junk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that magic drum was altered to be its optimum thing, this magic thing. But the legend grew, and that it was a Radio King. Well, I would venture to guess those guys probably were flying all over Los Angeles, finding Radio Kings for next yeah. to nothing and keeping the choice ones and tweaking them out. That's my theory. And I kind of think that might be, I've heard enough of that, that there's some truth to that, where the magic Radio King Jeff owned was altered. So yeah, but now people are like, oh, I gotta have it. And they'll spend $1,500 for one, and then be like, Phil was right. It sounds like a boxy piece of crap.
I'm going to make a bet right now that none of y'all want to take, that before we get to the next recording of the next show, somebody's going to weigh in on where this magic Beccaro snare drum came from.
Weigh in.
Yeah.
Well, that will be buried in the 1,400 emails we get saying we're full of crap. How dare we?
Yeah.
Mine sounds amazing, and it's stock. Okay, dude, cool. I'm happy for you.
Right on.
Especially if you got it at a music store closing for next to nothing.
Oh, man, way to bring that back. That nice callback, John.
I love deals, man. I can't get it out of my head. Hey, I want to touch on one other thing just because I need the therapy.
Do it.
A couple that got away. The two snare drums I regret selling and would give my left arm to get back. Maybe my right, because it annoys me more than my left, musically speaking. I had a 1960 Ludwig Super 5x14 brass.
Oh, yeah.
The magic
yeah.
welded shell, heavy lug. And for some reason, I think I had a couple Black Beauties, and I thought, oh, I'm good, and sold it. Dumb.
Yeah.
That drum, those drums are unbelievable, and whatever the price they are asking for now, they're worth it. They're going for like, you know, $500 to $800, depending on condition and the badge. But Ludwig Supers are amazing, precursor to the Black Beauty, mm-hmm. modern Black Beauty. Also, I had a Rogers Tower, which is kind of the lower budget but 8-lug version of the Power Tone.
Mm-hmm.
I got it in horrific condition. It was like a really bad re-rap of like Buddy Rich Sky Blue Pearl, which I hated.
Right.
But I had it re-wrapped in Silver Sparkle and a really amazing tech that was in Nashville forever named Tommy Winkler did the edges for me.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that drum to this day. I know my friend Jeff, we still talk about it. It was an unbelievably magic drum.
Why did you sell it? Somebody make you an offer you couldn't refuse?
I had a pretty good offer for it.
Yeah.
For both of those. And, you know, maybe I had, it was probably like the 1st of April. If you look back and saw that. I got you. That would be my guess.
This, I'm going to say this is the first time that the name brand Rogers has been brought up on this show.
That's a crime because my theory on Rogers in the 60s is like second to none, man. Their attention to detail is like what a modern company is now.
Exactly.
I mean, have you ever seen a Rogers drum with a bad edge?
I had a student that collected vintage Rogers kits.
Mm.
Man, and he had some nice ones too, Mardi Gras.
Yeah, they sound amazing.
Yeah. He had some, and I don't know if he still has them or not. I know he's not playing actively anymore. He's a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But man, he had some great old Rogers kits, man.
You need to find out about that.
Yeah.
Rogers to me, man, they're kind of like the perfect blend of vintage and modern because they had it sewed together. Their edges were, you know, really state of the art and consistent and a little sharper, but they still had that thin shell reinforcement hoop thing.
Yeah.
That's a great company, man. Forward thinking with hardware. They need a lot more love. There's some serious Rogers lovers out there. Don't get me wrong.
I wonder what caused their demise.
Typical of the 70s, larger company bought them out, and CBS, I think, bought them.
Okay.
And they kind of started. Although they held on for a while, because into the 80s, that big R straight shell version, those were still great drums.
Yeah. I remember Roy Burns used to play those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really good. I mean, when you're talking about a straight shell all maple,
mm-hmm.
they were on it, and they still had their act together, and their hardware was always really well thought out and forward thinking. But it's interesting why I don't know the exact reason it just eventually went by the wayside. Someone knows.
Yeah.
There's a great Rogers book Rob Cook does that has a lot of info. Be worth pulling up and looking through.
Yeah, and you know, I guess right around that same time is when we started, for all practical purposes, losing Slingerland as well.
Yeah, they both kind of went away about the same time, roughly. Mid-80s, they started kind of losing ground.
I mean, if you go to Gibson's website now, there's still a tab for Slingerland, but I mean, do they even make them?
No, they own the name.
Yeah.
They moved out to somewhere in Kansas for a while, and they said the quality was...
Yeah.
Because when they revived that, it was Sam Bacco.
Yep.
Legendary Nashville tech drum, you know, builder, and he made some. I've owned a couple of those Slingerland Nashville kits. Are incredible.
Yeah, heard nothing but good about the Nashville ones.
Really great. And they went to Conway, Arkansas. That's what it was. And I think they had just showed people how to build them, and they kind of went. There's been a lot of shoddy workmanship in that era.
John.
So they just quit making them.
If you ever went to Conway, Arkansas, you would. Nothing wants to be built there. Nothing wants to be in Conway, Arkansas.
So the people who were doing it correctly, the drums just started smoking crack and drinking and getting in fights and stuff, right?
Yeah, that whole Eastern Arkansas.
Yeah, I don't know it well.
About that,
I've been to Little Rock. That's about the extent of my Arkansas. Yeah. It can be the butt of many a joke. Like, I think even Alabama makes fun of Arkansas. It's sad.
It's possible, man. That's for sure.
And living in Georgia, we hear a lot of Alabama jokes, but they push off their frustration on Arkansas.
I've driven that. I think it's Interstate 55, man, that goes up that western part or eastern part of Arkansas, through the boot heel of Missouri going
comes
to St. Louis.
Illinois,
yeah.
too.
Yeah. Yeah, I've driven that
all the
road
way to Chicago, I think.
It might do it, yeah. Yeah. Well, guys, I hope we scratched the old gear itch. We've been promising for months, but we wanted to give you guys some love on snare drums because we feel like that we got to. We kind of went down a different path. We gave you some things that you probably expected, and then we took a sharp turn and gave you some drums that you probably, some of you maybe have never heard of them.
Maybe.
You know? So we just wanted to tell you kind of what we like. So
I just screwed the market up maybe on some sleepers.
You mean driving the prices up?
I can't get any Pearl ultrasound snares now, and Ludwig standards are going for $300.
The
loudmouth a-hole in Atlanta.
The Pearl Jupiter.
I swear, I was stockpiling those, and now it's, oh, wait, I can sell them.
There
you're
you go.
You're welcome.
So we're gonna finish out, and what we're going to talk about is pieces of must-have gear or underrated gear. And we haven't done one of these segments in a while either. It's been a few months since we've done this. So this is the All Gear All Day Long show.
Yes.
So the little piece of gear that I want to talk about is something that I actually recently acquired, John. And I actually know that you are a fan of it as well.
I am.
This piece of gear has been around for a little while, but I was a late adopter to it. And it was the kind of thing where you would hear about this name and you would even see the occasional video on social media where people were raving about it. And so it finally, I guess it hit the saturation point on me where I was like, you know, I guess I'd better check this out. And what it is it's a practice pad made by a company called Prologix. And the model of the practice pad is the Prologix 13-inch Red Storm practice pad. And brother, I am sold. And pretty much everybody that I've let play this practice pad, they have the same reaction. They look at it and they go, eh, looks just like a gum rubber practice pad. I'm sure it's exactly like the other 14 gum rubber practice pads out there. They pick up the sticks and then they play and they hit the first half dozen notes and they look up at you with that smile and they were like, this is not the same gum rubber practice pad. And essentially what it is it is a gum rubber practice pad, but it significantly has less rebound than the traditional, we'll just say, like real feel practice pad. It's a quiet practice pad. It has got, like I said, significantly more realistic feel. It has a hoop around it as well. And it will also fit inside the hoop of a traditional 14-inch snare drum. And I think, getting back to the construction of it, the magic is that it's actually got dual layers of playing surface, of gum rubber. And essentially what it is you've got a traditional, probably like a 3/8-inch red gum rubber on top that you play. And underneath it, it looks like there's some kind of open cell softer foam, or softer rubber, I should say, really, that's underneath it, that cushions it. It gives you a much more realistic feel. It's very quiet. And it's just awesome, man. I mean, it takes a lot for me to get excited about a practice pad because I've got about 10 of them. But this one is hands down the best one that I've got. It combines the realistic playing feel of, say, like one of the old school Remo practice pads. It has a drum head on it.
Yep.
But it's about 75% quieter. And then another cool thing about it is it's, again, super easy to transport. I've actually taken it out with me to gigs and on the road a little bit where what I will do is I will take the actual practice pad and just put it on the batter head of my snare drum and put that whole thing into a hard case. And it travels perfectly, man. So that's my pick. Check it out. It's the Prologix Red Storm practice pad. And again, the size that I got is the large one. It's the 13-inch practice pad. It's a little bit pricey, but you will know where the money went.
Hey, that pad is so cool that I've almost done something to be confused with practicing on it when I've been over here. You've seen me practice more here than I have in the last 30 years. Those 84 seconds that I played that pad speak volumes to how awesome it is.
It's really good, man. I mean, that in itself, I'm telling the Prologix folks, get in touch with us right now. Put John in your next print ad campaign. You will sell a zillion of these things.
Man, that's a pretty good idea.
It's an excellent idea, man. I'm telling you, because, I mean, they do. They feel, they make you want to practice.
The laziest drummer in the world is practicing. It's
quietly,
incredible.
Quietly.
Quietly, most importantly, especially when you start hearing my devils. I assure you, you want them quiet. Are those what?
Buzz, what?
Huh? Oh, I'm glad that thing's quiet.
That's why they call it a practice pad, right?
Right.
No judgments.
Oh, something that I use that I can't do without is Zildjian stick wax. And it started in some of these brutally hot 2-hour outdoor gigs that we do around Atlanta that are popular in our circles. You know, it's so insanely hot, and if you're sweating and over gripping and blistering up, don't even talk to me about technique, because under these conditions, technique had nothing to do with nothing.
That practice pad's going to help you out.
No, bro. You're just trying to hang on to a stick that you're sweating like to no end. And it did tear up your hands, you know. And I'm not a glove guy. I'm not going to wear gloves. So somebody just off the cuff recommended, hey, you try that stick wax. And I did, and I used it. The first time I used it on was a 4th of July long set, you know.
Yeah.
98 degrees and then some, you know, just brutal. And I came away unscathed, and I was like, oh, this is great. So I'm like, I'm going to keep that in my stick bag or wherever just to make sure I have it for a hot gig. I played it not long after that, you know, indoor, whatever, comfortable. And I didn't have them on the sticks, and I was like, I don't like this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I immediately was like some kind of psychological thing about like, man, I'm not thinking about, you know, being slippery or whatever. And so I realized, too, in the winter, I'm jumping all over the place, but in the winter when your hands dry out and kind of slick, I just put a little bit on. And I'm to the point now where psychologically, I have to have it on there or I'm bumming. And the only time I don't is I'm doing more of a low volume, straight ahead kind of thing. I don't like it on there because I do a lot more finger stuff. And
right.
So that stick wax, man, if you're struggling with, you know, the makeup of your skin or, you know, whether your skin's dry or whatever, like it just kind of has become the great equalizer. And I use it on almost every gig that, you know, outside of some finger control stuff.
A couple questions for you. Is that stuff, it's in a little jar or a can?
It's in a can.
Can. Is it beeswax? Is that what it is? Or
I don't know. It's blue. That stuff
blue I get. Wax. Blue wax. Yeah. Do you put it right on your hands or right on the stick?
No, I put it on a stick. And, man, you don't want to put too much on because it really can be a hindrance at that point. I just lightly, you know, right about in the grip, just not much. Go easy at first if you're going to try it.
Yeah.
Just use a little bit, but not on your hands. I do it on the stick.
I got a good marketing tagline for them.
What's that?
Little dab will do you.
Yeah.
You like
that's
that
true.
One? It's original.
You could get sued.
Little dab will do you?
Yeah, that was a hair product.
Oh, John.
When we were kids.
Oh, literal John.
Man, I don't want you to be financially burdened for running your big mouth. I'm looking out for you, man. Come on.
You didn't think I knew that was Vitalis. Little dab will do
you. No, I wasn't talking to you. I was really talking about someone who's going to run with that because you're distracted by something else and patent it and then get sued.
Man, thank you for looking out for me, brother.
And all you other people out there.
John, I'm done.
Dang, man.
I was just happy to make a day happen today, man. And you came over here and you drop all this good stuff on me.
What, stick wax?
Stick wax.
Woo-hoo.
Man, Ludwig Standard drums. Come on, man. Legend drums. Hadn't even heard that name in 20 years.
Great
awesome
stuff.
Yeah. Well, guys, thanks for listening. As always, we appreciate your listenership. We appreciate all the nice comments that we have, all the new Twitter followers coming in all the time. With that in mind, you can reach out to us at Twitter. It's twitter.com/DWGroovecast. Facebook, you can get to us at facebook.com/DrummersWeeklyGroovecast. And as always, the veritable Gmail email account for the old schoolers out there, drummersweeklygroovecast@gmail.com. We love hearing from you. And if you would, and you guys have been getting better about this, we appreciate this. The reviews are mounting on iTunes. Please, please continue. I'm going to go ahead and say create a fake account if you've already done one. Give us another review. We appreciate it. We are showing up whenever you hit the related button on other related drumming podcasts. We greatly appreciate it. So go into iTunes, leave us 5 stars, and just a short 1 or 2 sentence review telling us we're telling you to fake it. We appreciate it. John, you have anything else you want to say to these fine folks?
A little dab will do you.
A little dab will do you. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.